Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 11:42 a.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is September 1st. This article, where it and the highlight, the headline, "These robots are using static electricity to make Nikes," really grabbed my attention today because it's a sector that I've been paying, really keeping close attention on over the last couple of years, because we're seeing a rapid pace of technological innovation within the automation of creating garments. And there are millions of people employed in the garment industry, and these people are primarily in the emerging markets, and not really in all the emerging markets, but in those that are just coming into an industrialization period. These are the most impoverished countries in the world, is where textiles generally tend to be manufactured, because they are so cost sensitive that they seek out the lowest labor costs anywhere. And that's been the case since the Industrial Revolution. So that's a pattern of development that we have seen ample evidence of for the bones of 200 years, and it is potentially now in the process of being completely unwound, or at least impaired. And that's a really very important long-term theme. That's something that we really do have to give some weight to in terms of what we're thinking about in terms of the long term. So this being Friday and it being the big picture long-term audio and video, I thought that that's what I would start off to talk about. If there are millions of people employed in a sector, and you have companies which have a vested interest in competing to automate them out of the supply chain, then it's going to result in a very large disconnect. There are obviously going to be winners and losers, and that's something that we see with technology, not just in this particular sector, but everywhere. It is the way that technology gives with one hand and takes with the other, that there are winners in terms of the broad base of consumers become the winners, but then those that relied on whatever sector it is that has been automated for their employment, well, they are disconnected. And we've seen that happen in the steel sector. We've seen it happen in the coal sector. We've seen it happen in heavy industry, and this has created, this term, the Rust Belt, which we've seen, and we see the Rust Belt in not just the USA or in the UK, but in large other areas. We've seen that the car manufacturing sector no longer takes place in Australia, for example, that because it has been automated and moved to other areas that are more cost effective. But of course, the other side of that is consumers now can afford more cars. So then you have the give and the take in terms of this technological innovation. But what we are seeing increasing evidence of when we look around the world is that we see that there the numbers of people that are being affected by this is quite large. I saw this graphic in here today, and it was where the working class can or cannot afford to live in the USA. I found it to be quite interesting because considering just how much red there is on the graphic, you could potentially conclude that somebody who's on a working class wage couldn't possibly afford to live on anywhere on the coast of the USA. And that's a I think that is something that is a very important car it has to be an ingredient or part of the equation that we tend to think about in terms of how these trends are likely to evolve. Because we've already seen that a lot of people have benefited from technology, but a lot of people have been discomfited by technology at the same time. And the pace of technological innovation is accelerating. And if that is the case, then those trends where we will benefit and not benefit from that innovation is going to intensify, which is going to feed through into greater polarization on the political front. It's going to result in not just this populism that we're seeing arise, but it's also going to I think it's better to think not so much in terms of populism, but in reactionism, that people who have been discomfited by the pace of technological innovation, which has contributed to the disinflationary environment that has been evident in the global economy for the last 30 years, well, they're revolting against that status quo. And I think, that everyone is focusing on the election of President Trump and what that has meant in terms of populism. But there is an awful lot of debt needs to be refinanced in the period from 2019 through 2022. It would suggest that if this election was divisive, the next election could be considerably more so, because so far we haven't seen any progress being made on tax cuts or bringing down the cost of healthcare. And these are major, major considerations for the millions of people that are no longer able to support the lifestyle that they've been accustomed to, based on the wages that they're receiving. And I'm increasingly of the opinion, and this is the gasoline price, which has paused in here with the contract change, but if we look at the long-term chart of government bond yields, I'm increasingly of the opinion that this downward trend that's been in evidence since the early 1980s is, in many respects, analogous to the period of disinflation that has been created by the advent of technological innovation. And one of the ways that I tend to think of this particular question is in, I think, Kuhn and Feherabend's way of thinking of paradigm shifts. And when we think about that in terms of the scientific community, where you had, and the way that he described it was in terms of the shift in understanding that occurred between Newtonian physics and Aristotelian physics. The fact, for example, that Galileo was one of the first people to embark on experimentation to test a hypothesis when he dropped two balls of unequal weight off the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And what we're seeing is that for example, the introduction of the printing press was a transitionary environment. It was something that created this sea change in how we move information around, how we can communicate with one another. And that's what the internet has done as well. The internet has done something to the global economy that hadn't been done in upwards of 500 years, which was that it introduced a new way for us to communicate, and it contributed this incredible efficiency in terms of not only creating information but getting it out to people. That if Newton was able to say that he could stand, he was great because he stood on the soldiers on the shoulders of giants, excuse me. Well, how much more true is that today when we can communicate with each other in such an incredible fashion? And that is contributing to this massive pace of technological innovation. But what it, of course, means is that because it is contributing to this pace of technological innovation, what we are seeing is that there are these types of transitionary developments happening in other sectors as well, that it isn't going to take another 500 years before we get the next big transitionary move in terms of what we can expect from technological innovation. So, for example, the major car manufacturers are working towards and lodging patents on solid-state batteries. And that's likely to represent a step change in battery efficiency. Originally, Toyota said that they were going to be able to deliver that kind of battery by 2020, and they've pushed it back to 2022. But I think that it's important to really consider that it's 2022. It's not 2032, it's not 2050, it's within 5 years that they anticipate having a solid state battery that is considerably more efficient than the kinds of batteries that we have right now. What we're seeing in the battery sector right now is the build out of manufacturing capacity and the introduction of economies of scale into this particular sector. But what Tesla, for example, is doing is not really a massive innovation in terms of the technology that it is employing. What we need in order to really prove to be a massive transition and to drive this bull market forward in terms of energy and transportation is a step change in the technology. And if they can deliver on these solid catalysts for lithium batteries, then that could in fact deliver it. In just the same way that paper manufacturing arrived in Europe around the year 1000, but it didn't really take off until the printing press arrived. It needed a market, and that's what the printing press contributed to. Paper manufacturing was a pretty niche, I think that is the best way of describing it. It was a niche market until the invention of the printing press, and then it exploded. And I have a suspicion that that is what's going to happen with batteries, that electric vehicles are in existence today. But obviously, you have people that are very enthusiastic about owning an electric vehicle, and not least Tesla has been successful in creating a vehicle that people really want to own, that they aspire to own a Tesla. But we don't yet have the network of charging facilities. Charging takes a bit too long. The range and is still something that people are a little bit worried about. And then you've had all those stories about some of those Chinese cars that when they get to about a quarter of their power left, they start to slow down. It's not quite like an internal combustion engine that you get the same amount of power until it runs out of fuel. With a battery that, once you hit about 75% of the charge expended, then it just slows down. So that in China in the winter, they weren't able to get up the on ramps onto the onto the motorway and had to be pushed up. So that is the kind of thing that doesn't do wonders for confidence. But that's largely beside the point in if we think about the medium to longer term, because if we do get the delivery of a step change in battery efficiency, and it is certainly possible because by and large we're getting an improvement of about 8% per annum, and that's a worst case scenario, would be a doubling of energy density within 8 or 9 years. So if that's indeed the case, then what we can anticipate is that the market for electric vehicles will expand rapidly. And with the expansion of the electric car market, that represents a what is currently a pretty niche market turning into a major market, because the market for vellum evaporated when printing presses were created. Then it was so much easier to create paper, and I suspect that that is potentially what we could have from the internal combustion engine, but it's going to require this step change, a paradigm shift in how we really consider what the outlook is. Then, of course, when we start to also think about the other innovations that are going on in the transportation sector, such as autonomous vehicles and artificial intelligence, then it is also really advancing very rapidly because it is primarily about computing power. And there is this chicken and egg scenario with whereas previously the artificial intelligence didn't have enough of data, now they have so much data that they have to increase their computing power. But computing power is something that is achievable. We know that's achievable. We've been improving our computing power for decades, and certainly the size of chips is unlikely to get very much smaller beyond where it is right now, but that doesn't mean that the efficiency can't improve as we find new ways of layering chips so that we can get additional processing power. That's one area where we could have another step change. But another area that is increasingly in the news is in the biotechnology sector. Earlier this year, I believe it was in February, Illumina released their new architecture for genetic sequencers, and they estimated, and at the time, it cost about $1,000 to sequence a human DNA strand. But they estimate that with the new architecture and the way that it will be developed by users and the uses to which it will be employed, that they'll bring it down to about $100 within 3 or 4 years. And that's a phenomenal improvement in costs. But that is not a terminal level. It is perfectly reasonable that we're going to get to a point within the decade where it is going to be next to near free to sequence your DNA. That Novartis this week got its first permissioning for to release its CAR T cell treatment, which is an immuno-oncology treatment that re-educates the immune system to target cancer cells instead of ignoring them. And that's incredibly important. A lot of the news stories focused on the $495,000 price tag, but that's with today's technology. And if we do get down to a point in time where for genetic sequencing it gets very cheap, where the imposition of or the I think it's the utilization of CRISPR technology to edit the genes is employed much more widely. And I think it is worth highlighting that CRISPR technology is only 2 years old. It is brand new, and yet it is totally ubiquitous. It's being employed in every lab focusing on genetic sequencing everywhere. And at the same time, what we're seeing is the advent of synthetic biology. And synthetic biology is literally writing the code from scratch. And that's a rapidly evolving strategy as well. So what we have is the potential for, and certainly the first one of these treatments to hit the market is obviously going to be expensive. But with the costs of all of these things coming down, because they are primarily about computing power, then the potential for the cost of these kinds of treatments to trend lower in tandem is also very high. And that represents another step change, because what we have become conditioned to expect is progressively higher healthcare costs. That has certainly been the case for the last 30 to 40 years, that the number of people seeking medical care and the cost of delivering it has done nothing but trend higher. It also represents a significant social burden for people that have to pay for insurance or have to pay their taxes to fund national insurance. And that represents a significant challenge. And not least as we move into a period of time where there are going to be a lot of people over the age of 65. So that also represents this paradigm shift. It represents the advent of I guess really the advent of personalized medicine. And that's going to represent a massive benefit for consumers. But it's not going to be great for all the people that rely on these kinds of sectors for jobs, because it is going to streamline a lot of these processes. And it just highlights the fact that what we're going to see is a much more technical workforce. And that's going to require more education, and it's going to require a different mindset. And there's going to be a premium on creativity. And there isn't any of us doesn't have a creative spark, but I think it is also true that each one of our all of our creativity is focused on a different area. And certainly there is the evolution of the service sector, and at the expense of the manufacturing sector is likely to remain a significant trend over the medium term. But we can't simply think that everything is going to take care of itself, because there are going to be a lot of people are going to be disconnected from what they thought of as a secure environment. That's likely to represent a significant challenge going forward. Something that we can anticipate is going to play out over the medium to longer term. And what we're seeing in terms of the technology imposition into various sectors is particularly occurring in the retail sector right now, where the share of online is the share of the retail market that online is garnering is just becoming progressively higher. And I think if you just think about where you spend your money and how you spend your money and how much you spent on online 5 years ago versus this year, and how much you're likely to spend next year, then the trend is quite clear. Because it's so easy to get on your mobile phone and shop on Amazon, whereas going out and traipsing around a mall and carrying, often rather heavy bags home, is kind of laborious. And what you definitely see in terms of the successful shopping malls is that they become entertainment destinations. They have to become attractive, and what they prosper on is on food and entertainment, and hopefully you might do some shopping in between. I certainly know that our family generally tend to go to malls for the restaurants, not so much for the stores. We do practically all of our shopping online, and I suspect that considering our particular demographic, that we are probably representative of the majority. So when we think about those sorts of trends over the medium term, it's likely to continue to that the pace of technological innovation, the rise of the global consumer, and the revolution that we're getting in the energy sector is likely to continue to support the bull market in stocks. And the S&P 500, for example, broke up and away from a 13-year range in 2013, and it has paused in the region of 2,500. But so far, this has been a very consistent advance. And rather than worrying about, and we know that a bull market climbs a wall of worry, we should really ask ourselves, is there any evidence of trend ending? And the answer right now is no. As long as the answer remains no, then we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. It's being led higher by the Nasdaq. And what we're seeing is an increasing polarization of winners and losers within the stock market. And I think that that is particular poignant for the consumer staples sector. And particularly the S&P 500 consumer staples, because it has got a little bit of everything in there. It has got it's got supermarkets and retailers. It's got processed foods and beverages, and it's got cosmetics. And I think one of the more important points is that it fell less than just about everything else, and it bottomed ahead of the wider market. It bottomed in February. The wider market didn't bottom until April. And it remains still in a reasonably consistent advance. When this rolls over, it's going to represent potentially a lead indicator for a somewhat larger pullback. There isn't any bull market that doesn't have occasional setbacks, and if it remains a secular bull market, they represent very important buying opportunities. When we think about what the likelihood is of when we're likely to get the next recession, then there isn't really any indication that it's around the corner. In fact, what we're seeing greater evidence of is that we're in a period of synchronized global economic expansion. We're seeing an increasing number of markets breaking up and out of long-term ranges, and I'll show you some of those. But when we look at the yield curve, then what we're presented with is a ratio, or it's a spread that has long-term predictive capability. That when it is below zero, when you have an inverted yield curve, it's a lead indicator for recessions for anything between 12 and 18 months. And so far, it might be contracting, and it has been contracting for the last few years, but it is at 80 basis points. And that would suggest that if it takes another year to get to zero, then we are 2 years away from the next recession. And that would put us square in the period of time when a great deal of the debt that has to be refinanced or that will expire after a 10-year time horizon and will need to be refinanced between 2019 and 2022 comes due. That is not an unreasonable expectation that the higher financing costs will represent a headwind for global growth and that we could have a recession as a result. And I think that we could probably consider that that is perhaps the base case. And if that is the case, then the potential is that we could have an acceleration higher, that the market could become very much more captivated by the outperformance of the technology sector, by the I expect to see more people talking about the pace of technological innovation and the incredible impact that that's having on our lives and the necessity that one has to own it, and that it has the potential to create an accelerating price environment. And that would encourage the central banks to raise interest rates a bit more aggressively. But right now, we are in a period of time where the Federal Reserve is beginning to talk about what to do about the size of their balance sheet. They have raised rates from incredibly low levels on four occasions in the last 18 months, and we are still only at 1.25%. The ECB hasn't raised rates for what feels like forever, and the last time they raised rates, they had to reverse course almost immediately. The Bank of England is still dealing with the Brexit question, so they're unlikely to be to want to raise interest rates, and they will delay that decision as long as they can. The Japanese are unlikely to raise interest rates, and China is also at a period where and most particularly coming up to the Party Congress in late October, they're going to be reluctant to do anything to choke off supply. When we look at the size of central bank balance sheets and on an aggregate basis and rebased to US dollars, then what we're presented with is this trend higher that has persisted. I don't know why that's not working, and which has persisted despite all of the commentary that we've had about tapering and about raising interest rates. Central bank balance sheets are currently around $19.5 trillion. The ECB has doubled the size of its balance sheet in less than 3 years. So we are still in an environment where there is plenty of money sloshing around. And as long as that remains the case, it's unlikely to represent a headwind. But if we get to a point where they are more serious about reviewing the size of the expansions or about withdrawing some of that liquidity, then that is going to have an impact on what we can expect from other markets. So that's something that we have to bear in mind. When we look at the commodity markets, then gold prices are currently around $1,325. They have cleared the $1,300 area, and it is looking increasingly likely that this represents a recovery scenario. The most important thing gold has done in the last 6 years has been to break that medium-term downtrend in early 2016, and this represents a first step above the Type 2 bottom. And as long as it is ranging between $1,100 and $1,400, we can continue to hold that conclusion. If it can sustain a move above $1,400, well, we're back in a new medium-term cyclical bull market. But it would be folly to think that we're still in a secular bull market. When we look at the Dow Gold Ratio and look at it over a very long period of time, there are long periods of time when equities outperform, and relatively short period of time by comparison when commodities outperform. We went through a more than 10-year-long period of time where gold did fantastically well on both a relative and absolute basis. And now we are at a point where it is likely that over on a secular time horizon, stocks will outperform gold. That doesn't mean that we can't have cyclical bull markets, and it is certainly looking up for the precious metals right now. Silver prices have also started to firm up. And what we can also say is that platinum is certainly leading the way higher. It's obviously much more of an industrial metal, but it was up $46 in here today. It is rapidly approaching this $1,000 level. And I think at this stage, we can begin to talk about acceleration. It has done fantastically well over the last few months. So $1,000 is a big psychological level for just about any commodity, and it has also contributed to some resistance for platinum. And it is just breaking through that $1,000 level in here today. And because they have come down so much, they have potential to outperform in the next few months. But I think that the precious metals are now more trading assets. They're not so much things that one would buy and hold, for the simple reason that we are back in a secular bull market environment for stocks. And that would suggest that it is stocks that one wants to buy when they are reasonably cheap, or buy when you do get the occasional fallout, because you will be rewarded that this is the birth of the buy and hold scenario, and on a secular basis. That doesn't mean that we're not in the latter stages of a pretty lengthy cyclical bull market in equities. That's why we're seeing the commodity sector moving to outperformance, because it is these cyclical sectors tend to do best in the latter stages of a cyclical bull market. Then, once and it is the cyclical sectors aren't the ones that peak last. That is why I'm watching the consumer discretionary sector and this consumer staples sector, because they were such strong performers off the lows, and they were among the leading sectors that if they start to roll over, that's likely to be a lead indicator for the end of the cyclical bull market, which will present us with a buying opportunity in terms of the secular bull market. I think that considering the very important long-term trends that we have out there in the market, that there is the potential for an attractive buying opportunity to present itself within the next few years before we move progressively higher in terms of this long-term bull market. And if we look at what we see from a number of global markets right now, it is consistent with synchronized global economic expansion. Taiwan is trading above 10,000 for the first time since the early 1990s. The Thai index has really just is just in the process of breaking out. The South African market has been breaking out. And what is, I think, very important is that the number of markets that are breaking out to new all-time highs far outweighs the underperformers. Even Japan, which has been a serial wallflower for decades, is firming up. And when we look at it on a long-term basis, then the TOPIX has been trading below 1750 for over 20 years. And it is looking increasingly likely that it will be able to sustain a move up and out of it. And that's really quite important. So when we think about the long term, then I think we are in a secular bull market, but we're also in the latter stages of a cyclical bull, and that the return to outperformance of these markets and the evolution of the synchronized global economic expansion will lend confidence to central banks that they can begin to withdraw liquidity. So we're still in this Goldilocks period where growth is picking up, but the central banks have not yet raised interest rates. Eventually, they will raise interest rates. We will get negative, we will get an inverted yield curve, and that will contribute to where we get when we get the next recession. But as I said, there's very little sign of that anytime soon. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.